you make the claim in a number of ways, in a number of your books, that I think may be shocking to some 21st century readers or even sometimes scholars. And it's this claim that Western atheism is a novel movement.
Does doctrine really matter? The Apostle Paul once wrote to a young pastor named Titus, instructing him to hold firm to the trustworthy word he was taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine. Welcome to Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. Here's your host, Dr. Matthew Barrett, executive editor of Credo Magazine and associate professor of Christian theology at Midwestern Seminary.
Welcome to the Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters. I am Matthew Barrett, your host, and let me invite you to join me for not just a theological conversation today, but even a philosophical conversation. You know, many times when we think about the Christian God, sometimes even as Christians, we can fall into the trap, or the danger, I would call it, of thinking of God in finite terms. Rather than thinking of a God who is high and lifted up, as Isaiah talked about, we can tend to think of God as one that we can tame, one we can even domesticate, as C.S. Lewis talked about in his Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We want a type of Aslan that is safe. And in our conversations about God, sometimes this has the effect of resulting in a God who is bound by time and space, even a God who changes, perhaps even a God who's made up of parts, or to use more of the philosophical language, a God who is compounded of parts. And as a result, we end up with a very finite picture of God. I don't think it's any surprise then that this leaves us open not only to historical discontinuity, but also to contemporary challenges and opposition from certain quarters of the atheistic movement, in which, well, our God looks a lot like us, but is just a greater one, perhaps just greater in degree. And the consequence of this is, well, atheism can look at our God and see our God is really not that unique in the end. Well, I am delighted to have with me today on the Credo Podcast a philosopher, an Eastern Orthodox philosopher, if I think we can say that, David Bentley Hart. And this is really a unique conversation to have with Dr. Hart, because in many ways we've been talking to theologians, but here we have the chance to talk to someone who has not only thought about theology, but philosophy in a variety of ways. He's the author of many books, and I'm sure our listeners are familiar with a number of them: The Story of Christianity, The Beauty of the Infinite. He's also written a book called The Hidden and the Manifest. One of my favorite books, though, is it wasn't written that long ago, his book, The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness, Bliss. You may also know him from his book, The Atheist Delusions, The Christian Revolution and Its Fashionable Enemies. Most recently, though, he has been busy at work translating the New Testament. You can find his translation of the New Testament available now. And of course, he is not just a writer, but he also is a teacher. He's been the assistant director of undergraduate research assistants at Notre Dame Institute for Advanced Studies. David, it is really a delight and a joy to have you on the Credo Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Now, we need to talk about the most important things first. Maybe we could talk about first principles here for a moment, because I think I'm right in saying that you are first and foremost a baseball fan. And tell us, I'm of course rooting for the Royals, but I don't think you're going to be rooting for the Royals, are you?
No, I'm a diehard Orioles fan. I'm a Marylander from way back. So this looks like it's going to be a year of tragedy and affliction. But these come in cycles. Another 30, 40 years, maybe we'll get another championship.
That's right. Well, if you're an Orioles fan, you must be used to this by now. I mean, I think it comes with the territory, though, of course.
No. Remember, the first 20 years of my life, the Orioles had the best winning record in the majors. I grew up in the Frank Robinson, Brooks Robinson, Jim Palmer,
okay,
Paul Blair, and then on to Eddie Murray, era when the Orioles were absolutely invincible. So actually, I've never gotten used to them being a losing franchise. From childhood on, I always expected them to be in a pennant race. So I'm afraid that one's childhood forms one's expectations ever thereafter.
How true that is. It's one of, I hate to say this, but it's really one of those situations where you really need a resurrection of those early years. Maybe we call them the golden years of baseball.
Or a revenue sharing rule in baseball that actually redistributes income.
That's right.
You can become a hard Marxist when you're a baseball fan, in a small market.
Now, is everyone in Maryland an Orioles fan?
Well, I imagine now that there's some people who live in Maryland who aren't Marylanders around the D.C. area who follow the Nationals, but, they're the children of wrath, so I don't associate with them,
Okay. Well, we'll keep them in prayer.
But a Marylander, someone, who has it bred in the bone, yes, is an Oriole fan. Yeah. Bleed black and orange.
They're playing the Phillies today. And the Phillies,
yes.
I think I'm right in saying they're 23-16.
Surprisingly, I wouldn't have thought they would have been even halfway decent this year.
Do you have a call for the game today? It hasn't started yet. Any predictions?
Well, the Orioles have been getting people back off the injured list, so they've been pounding out about an average of 12 runs a game for a week. So I'm going to hope that continues.
Okay. We need hopefully that injured list will start to disappear as the season goes on, but you never can tell, really. Well, let's move from baseball, though of course baseball provides so many fitting analogies. I find myself often in the classroom turning to either basketball, because I am a basketball fan, but also baseball at times, to talk about God's character, though that seems odd, doesn't it? But at times, even when I've tried to explain what God is and what he's not, let's say with an attribute like simplicity, baseball just seems to come into the conversation. Has this happened to you? I mean, you've been in even a number of public speaking venues or even debates. Has baseball ever become a metaphor?
Oh, well, I prefer to think that life is a metaphor for baseball, but in point of fact, yeah. I, years ago, published an essay on baseball, which has followed me ever since. It gets reprinted a lot and quoted a lot, so again and again in public venues, it gets brought up, usually in connection with some abstruse metaphysical point. Especially clever graduate students can be very inventive in making the connection.
Mm. Yes. Sometimes they can run with it in ways that we probably never imagined. And where is that essay published, by the way?
Well, originally it was in First Things years ago.
Okay.
I think it's in my collection called A Splendid Wickedness.
Okay.
Which came out about 2 years ago.
Well, for our listeners, if you want to be introduced to David Hart's writings, maybe this is a good place to begin. Go to First Things, read his essay on baseball, or better yet, get that book, A Splendid Wickedness.
And yeah, that's a good collection. I advise that. In fact, I say buy 10 or 15 copies and distribute them. They make great presents.
Yes, and certainly a volume like that, and that's not just the only volume in which you have a collection of essays. I think, am I right in saying,
I have about four volumes of essays.
Yes, The Hidden and the Manifest.
Hidden in the Manifest, that's more technical essays, articles, you know, the kind that come with footnotes. Whereas Splendid Wickedness and In the Aftermath is another one, and there's yet another one called The Dream Child's Progress. Those are essays rather than articles. So they are for reading rather than that. There's no critical apparatus attached. You don't have to speak Greek.
Well, perhaps those are the ones to turn to if someone wants to ease into your writings, maybe just before bedtime, I suppose, or maybe in the morning for devotions. But and maybe from there they can turn to some of your more heavily annotated or footnoted essays and books after that. While we're on the subject of your books, there seems to be a theme that comes out throughout your writings, one that you're passionate about and one that is relevant really to so much of what you address. And that is, your career in some ways, correct me if I'm wrong, but in some ways could be described as a counter to not just maybe some popular atheism, but also to the type of God that would be finite, as opposed to what comes out of much of your writings, which is a classical view of God. Yeah. You make the claim in a number of ways, in a number of your books, that I think may be shocking to some 21st century readers or even sometimes scholars, and it's this claim that Western atheism is a novel movement, I imagine this claim is probably very provocative in a secular environment as well, and mostly because when you're claiming that when you look at the history of the church, or just the history of Western thought, really, that prior to the modern era, this is not atheism, Western atheism, as we know it today, is really not there. At one point, you write this, that there has sprung up a whole generation of confident, even strident atheist proselytizers who appear to know almost nothing about the religious beliefs they abominate and who seem to have no real sense of what the experience of faith is like or of what its rationales might be. And that strong statement, I think, is fitting in many ways. Why do you think atheism, and here I have in mind, you know, contemporary Western atheism, why is it that it is caught on in this fashion when in the history of the church this just wasn't so, and really the history of the world, this would have been unthinkable?
Well, I mean, it's a complicated question. I think that the point that I make about the current state of atheism is that it's disappointing at the intellectual level. That is, that there have been prior generations of early modern atheists, but that they were still, two things. One, grounded in a tradition that they somewhat understood, that is, Nietzsche, for instance, in the 19th century, his father was a pastor. He had grown up in a very pious household. So when he rejected what he understood as the faith he was raised with, it was a rejection that was not colored by total ignorance of either the experience of faith or the object of faith. When you read someone like Richard Dawkins today, or A.C. Grayling, or Daniel Dennett, the first thing that strikes you is just the profound ignorance. At the philosophical level, they're addressing a picture of God that isn't even one endorsed either by Christianity or any major theistic tradition at all. I mean, you can step outside of Christianity and still find that this picture of God is a more caricature than anything else. but also that if they get these rather banal characterizations of what faith consists in, what the passion of faith is. Now, in part, Christianity has done this to itself, and or not just in part, to a very great degree. I think that the atheist picture of God that someone like Dennett rejects is simply an inversion of a kind of either fundamentalist picture or intellectually inadequate picture of God that's been incubated within, excuse me, within confessionally Christian circles over the years. It's not as if it's not as if this sort of disbelief has not been invited by certain supposed advocates of faith. But it is strange. We have reached a moment in history when secularism is well enough established in Western culture that atheists can start from a totally fabulous picture of belief. It's as if they're talking about unicorns or dragons rather than about anything that a person who actually believes would understand as his or her faith.
We've been talking to David Bentley Hart, the Eastern Orthodox philosopher, but let's take a break and hear from one of our sponsors.
Midwestern Seminary's 81-hour Master of Divinity degree prepares you for ministry today and tomorrow. Midwestern Seminary's flagship degree program is our primary track for ministry preparation. Requiring only 81 credit hours, the MDiv program is an efficient option for students, equipping them to serve the church in pastoral ministry. Residential students will be trained in a unique community environment passionately focused on the local church. Online students can earn the full degree without leaving their current ministry context. Come be a part of one of the fastest growing seminaries in North America as we develop a new culture of discipleship devoted to the local church and committed to taking God's unchanging word into a rapidly changing world. Visit mbts.edu/mdiv today.
We're back from our break, and we're ready to jump into a very philosophical conversation with David Bentley Hart. Now, you've hinted at this in what you've just said, but one of the ways in which popular atheism dismisses the Christian God is by this very common move, an instinct, or really a default instinct, to categorize, say, the Christian storyline or the Bible storyline along with just every other fairy tale. You say at one point, I believe, it really, really went, what this comes down to is this assumption that one could say, well, I believe neither in God nor in the fairies at the bottom of my garden, as you yourself say in one of your books. But you've pushed back against this assumption, first and foremost, because you've said, well, this is a category mistake.
You have a perfect indication of how poorly the sort of popular atheist movement grasps what's at stake traditionally when people talk about God, especially if they mean to take on the intellectual tradition of Christianity or Judaism or what have you. And obviously, I mean, I think quite often when they try to, as Richard Dawkins' rather touchingly maladroit attempts to argue against Thomas Aquinas, which is, I think, rather like watching a dolphin trying to tap dance, you realize just how utterly unacquainted they are with the terms of the debate. And that's a perfect example. The person I was quoting there actually was A.C. Grayling, who is putatively a trained philosopher, though he's more of a newspaper columnist with a philosophical degree these days. But it shows you that he's unable to make a simple distinction between kind of what philosophy would be called modal claims being made. If there are fairies, or if there are gods, Zeus or Wotan, or Votan rather, or whoever you will, as usually conceived, they would be beings within nature. And the only sort of claims one would make for their existence is that you're acquainted with them, or that you've heard about them, or that you know something about their mysteries and how they've revealed themselves. But really, the only way you could establish whether or not Zeus exists is it'd be something analogous to a scientific investigation to see whether a certain species of butterfly could be discovered. You'd have to go looking. It's an empirical question. Now, you would think someone like A.C. Grayling would look at the history of theistic thought and notice that those are not the kind of arguments being made about God. That the arguments that are being made about God are not about a discrete, finite being within the fold of nature. We have an empirical knowledge in the way we would of a tree or some other object, but rather they're making logical arguments. And arguments about logical necessity and about modal contingency and about the conditions of the existence of anything. And if those are the arguments being made, then obviously we're in a completely different category of claims. We're not talking about an object who's available only to empirical investigation. In fact, we're talking about a truth that's available to reason. And that means that we're not talking about anything within the same continuum. To make it a very simple matter, if God were a finite being who existed as a god among gods, and, you know, there might be gods out there, you know, kicking around the golf course, retired now.
Baseball field, more likely, I think.
I'm sorry, what?
The baseball field, more likely than the golf course, I imagine.
Well, it's true. I was just trying to think of an image of retirement, and golf is the one game you can play even after you're dead.
That's true.
So, but in any event, but when all these traditions talk about God, they're talking about the ground of all reality, the source of all being, the beginning and end of all things, the logically necessary terminus of thought when it seeks to find the conditions for the existence of anything that does exist. And it just strikes me as odd that someone like Grayling, who should be acquainted simply with classical texts, could be so utterly ignorant of the difference in modal vocabulary and difference in philosophical category that he could say something like that. And yeah, unfortunately, it's typical of the entire current generation of atheist proselytizers.
Do you think someone like Grayling, or it doesn't even have to be him, it could be, as you've just mentioned, some of his disciples or contemporaries?
Friends,
yep. Yes. Do you think that this type of caricature, I mean, is this just due to the fact that they look at, say, the miracles throughout Scripture, and they just think, well, that's fantastic, that's impossible, that's something of the storybooks, and so they just assume that this is just the God of these miracles is just the same category as say the Greek gods.
Well, I mean, even the Greek gods weren't real. I mean, look, I mean, there are mythical characterizations of God in the Bible as well. I mean, that's simply the fact. I mean, I'm not a fundamentalist, so let me be clear about this. The revelation of God is a progressive reality in the history of Israel and the church. And so there are plenty of passages that you could read that way, but later Jewish and Christian tradition both interpreted them as images with a deeper meaning. But I don't think, I mean, I think you're overestimating the degree of hermeneutical sophistication here. I mean, someone like A.C. Grayling probably is scarcely aware of the stories, let alone the intellectual tradition that made sense of them for Christians. I think for him, any claim about God is, you know, whether it's Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or anything else, it's all going to be the same thing. It's going to be of peace with a polytheistic picture of some finite being who's sort of psychological. way that a mechanic makes a car or a sculptor makes a statue, as if, you know, dealing and much of their understanding, remember, of things like the doctrine of creation, don't actually come from the Christian intellectual tradition. They come from a later deistic understanding of God as the creator and superintendent of an essentially mechanistic universe that's extrinsic to him, and he's just some sort of very large, very capable, very resourceful technician. Part of what they're reacting to is a picture of God that was created in early modernity as an alternative to the classical theistic picture, which they have ineptly confused with the classical theistic picture.
Now, a minute ago, you said with someone like Grayling or even others, Dawkins, Dennett, that you are surprised that they are unfamiliar with modal terms, modal categories. For our listeners who maybe they don't have a background in philosophy, can you just explain for a second here, what does modal terms mean when you are referring to this creator-creature distinction?
Well, in terms of logic, in terms of modal logic, it's a very simple thing. Modality there usually refers to truths that are contingent and truths that are necessary, right? Things that are possible and things that are impossible, things that are actual as opposed to possible. And so it's a very limited area of logical terminology. I'm using it because it points to what I would call the larger ontological claims of classical tradition, which helps you make distinctions. When you talk about God, you're not talking about a being who in any sense is contingent on a larger order, who engages a reality that's greater than or beyond himself. You're not talking about a God who is made up, as we are, of the potential and the actual, but rather is pure actuality as such, you know, things like that. It would take some years of instruction. I mean, a podcast is a bad place to kind of launch into, you understand, the fundamentals of metaphysical terminology, but that's really what you mean when you're talking about modal logic, is trying to make distinctions between what sort of realities you're talking about. And it helps you clarify that God does not fit in the class of beings. It doesn't, he's not one thing in addition to all other things in the universe. The universe doesn't add anything to the being of God. He is already all that is, and the universe exists only as a kind of contingent, gratuitous participation in the being that flows from him as a gift, as a creative gift. Now, that being so, logically, you're not talking about God if you're talking about a God. You know, these are just two different. And the funny thing is, this is even understood in the ancient world before Christianity, remember. I mean, even in the pagan world, by the time Christianity came along, there are very advanced metaphysical systems of monotheism in which the difference between God and the gods is pretty absolute. Christians borrowed that language. And when they spoke Greek, for instance, they made a distinction between ο Θεός, that is God in the fullest sense, and then things that could be called, that could be named, Theos, you know, a god or a daemon or a divinity, things like that, so that Paul, in the book of Acts, could say to the Athenians, I see that you revere the daimonian in all things. That's usually translated as divine, but it shouldn't be, because it's not a reference to God in his fullness. It's a reference to these sort of intermediate created divine realities, the angels who govern the nation, say, in Jewish thought, which he would have inherited, or what the pagans understood as local divinities, you know, or demons. So even before Christianity came along, it's just the truth of human reason that a distinction can be made between God in the full sense, God as the ground of all reality, the source of all reality, infinite actuality, infinite being, simplicity, immutability, right? That is the transcendent God from whom all things come. And then, you know, whatever myth or religion. religion or local culture posits as these finite spiritual powers. So for Christianity, the intellectual categories were already there. Jews and Christians alike had already made this distinction. So it's curious that someone like A.C. Grayling, for instance, is going to launch an attack against Christianity, which is marked by a total ignorance of even the most basic metaphysical, the most basic philosophical, the most basic religious distinctions that were there at the very beginning.
Now, what you've just mentioned is extremely important. I'm not sure I can stress this enough to our listeners, just how important this is, because you've mentioned a text like Acts 17, but you've also just mentioned the larger reality that even, you know, at the very beginning, Christians are those who are distinguished. They're aware, as you just mentioned, as Paul is, but they are very much distinguished in their understanding of God from the, you know, deities, we could say with a lowercase d, that they're aware of around them. Now, this type of distinction that defined Christianity from the start, this is a really key component, isn't it? Because oftentimes the accusation or maybe the caricature that comes in at this point is that, well, if you hold to a classical understanding of God, that's just the God of Aquinas or Anselm or maybe Augustine, but that's not, that type of God is completely foreign to Christianity in its original forms or what we see in the Bible. But
so you confine yourself to Western references there.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
Cappadocian Fathers, Maximus the Confessor,
yes.
Theophylact.
Athanasius.
And Plato and Aristotle and the whole, well, Plato, actually, or at least the Neoplatonists, too. I mean, it's this sort of classical picture you'll be told, is, since it has adherents outside of Christianity, is therefore somehow not biblical either. Well, I mean, the thing is, of course, if that were so, that would mean that the first generations of Christian thinkers were all deeply deceived about what they believed in, wouldn't it? Because we find that as early as the first generation, not just the first generation, people like apologists, Justin Martyr, for instance, and others, but even in the scripture itself, take the Gospel of John. Here it helps if you read Greek, which I understand not everyone does, but even there, in the very beginning, a distinction is made between God in the fullest sense, all theos, and Theos. Now, the question that it raises in chapter 1, but in a sense, only answers progressively throughout the gospel and then definitely answers clearly in chapter 20, is the Logos o Theos or Theos? Is he God in himself? Is he co-equal with the Father, you know, to use the language of Nicaea? Or is he just a sort of divine messenger, a creature or an emanation or a reduced manifestation of God, because in the prologue to the gospel, using language that everyone would have understood intellectually in the first century, the Father is referred to as O Theos, but it's not clear that the Logos is. But then, in the course of the gospel, Christ will say things like, you know, I, the Father, one, he has seen me, you see the Father still. That would have been considered consistent with a picture in which Christ is not understood as co-equal with the Father. But then in chapter 20, and this is why it's necessary to know the Greek, the Apostle Thomas addresses him as O Theos. O Kyrios mou ke O Theos, my Lord and my God. Now, why is that important? Well, it shows that already in the Gospel of John, a distinction has been made. Already it's understood there's a difference between talking about God as the transcendent one, who is the source of all things, and a God, who might manifest that source, but who is not the source. And so, I mean, already, if you know the language, the philosophical language of the time, if Christ is spoken of as the express image, the character of God, you're already deeply enmeshed in the language that was shared by monotheistic pagans, Hellenistic Jews, and Christians of the first generation. generation that, all, that presumed all these metaphysical categories. So when you say, you know, what's the biblical God? Well, the biblical God of the New Testament is, among other things, most definitely fully developed, metaphysically defined understanding of the transcendent God that you then find in later tradition expressed by, say, Maximus the Confessor or Thomas Aquinas or Anselm.
Now, of course, when you're referring to some of these fathers, it's not, as you pointed out a minute ago, it's not just an Augustine or an Anselm or an Aquinas, those in the West, but it's also those in the East.
There is a, no, I mean, East, West, ancient, patristic, medieval, up to the modern period. This is the common voice of all Christians. I mean, to reject that metaphysics is basically to reject the whole line, the whole continuum of Christian thought from the first generation to the present.
We've been talking with David Bentley Hart, the Eastern Orthodox philosopher and thinker, and we've really been discussing a variety of issues, some having to do with Western atheism as a novel movement, perhaps a claim that might surprise some, but David Bentley Hart's been arguing that, well, actually, it is novel, and there is even a difference between, say, the atheism of yesterday and the atheism today, and their lack of understanding of the metaphysics of the doctrine of God, doctrine of the Christian God. But we've also been turning to really in-house debates, even among Christian philosophers and theologians, as to how to understand that God, whether this God really is the source or the ground of all reality, as Hart has claimed. And so how we come down or where we come down on these types of issues and whether we understand what's at stake, well, that has a lot to do with how these atheistic thinkers are perceiving us, our doctrine of God, and whether they're doing so accurately or not. I would invite you, this is really part one, but I would invite you to return to the second part of this conversation. And there we will not just continue with some of these concepts we've been discussing, but there we will get into some of the history as well. Why is it that both the East and the West have this same doctrine of God? And how do the attributes of God, attributes like aseity, immutability, concepts like God is pure act, how do these help us avoid thinking of God as, say, someone who is just slightly bigger than we are, or what Hart calls monopolytheism? How do we avoid this type of thinking and instead, along with the tradition that's preceded us, understand God as really the first cause, the unmoved mover?
Now you can fill up on theology each day by visiting credomag.com. There you will find the latest issues of Credo Magazine with articles on key doctrines of the faith, and regular video interviews with Dr. Matthew Barrett, where he answers some of the toughest theological questions of our day. Be sure to subscribe to Credo Podcast to join the conversation, a conversation where doctrine matters.